Systemic racism has been built into laws and policies for centuries, and it affects everyone. It's led to racial inequity in Alaska and beyond. Now, organizations around the state are working together to educate people about the problems and develop solutions. Today on Talk of Alaska, we'll learn about what systemic racism looks like in Alaska and how conversations and increased understanding of the issue are leading to change.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. It's back to school time. Backpack ready, school supplies check. But what about your child's vaccinations? Before school starts is a great time to talk to your health care provider or a local public health center to make sure your child's vaccinations are current. Vaccinations protect your child and the whole community against serious diseases. Learn more, including where to get free vaccines, at immunize.dhss.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by DHSS. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
This is Talk of Alaska. I'm Ann Hillman. Organizations and governments sometimes enact policies that favor one racial or ethnic group over another. Sometimes it's intentional, sometimes it's not. Today, we're talking about systemic racism and racial equity. This program is part of Alaska Public Media's Solutions Desk, a look at what's making Alaska communities stronger. And today, I'm going to allow my guests to introduce themselves. Lisa.
Well, Lisa Gahn, good morning. Lisa Wade Suzetlan, Taltina Atlant, Night Daniana Kayacht, Sintiaran, Tidekatna Ista. My name is Lisa Wade, and I am from Chicoloon, Alaska, and I am a member of the Water Clan. And also, I work for Chicoloon Village Traditional Council as the Health, Education, and Social Services Director and a council member.
Hoka, Huinga Agatlaugo. I said, hello, my name is Andrea Agatlak Sanders. I was born and raised out in Mamtereitlak in Bethel, Alaska, and I work currently as the Alaska Native Policy Center Director at First Alaskans Institute here in Anchorage.
Jinan and Quiana, thank you both very much for being here. Listeners, if you have seen examples of systemic racism, if you have questions about this issue, share your experiences and ask questions by calling us at 1-800-478-8255 or here in Anchorage, 550-8422. Again, the number statewide is 1-800-478-8255. You can also email talk@alaskapublic.org. So before we jump into the meat of the topic, I want to make sure that we're all on the same page and listeners understand what we're talking about. And I was wondering if, Lisa, if you could define exactly what systemic racism is and what it looks like.
That's a really large definition, and it's a very complex definition because it's different in many different situations. So it's very contextual. But at the most fundamental level, it's where systems are either built around us or policies or practices benefit one group at the expense of another group, essentially. That's a really rough, raw definition. There's definitely a different Webster's definition. But it's such a complex question, I think it needs to be even dissected down further.
Okay.
So I think your example might be appropriate at this time, and
yeah, Andrea,
maybe you could talk about that, Andrea.
You had put forth an example of how it's kind of like a Monopoly game.
Yeah, so within our work at First Alaskans Institute, you know, we've been hosting a racial equity healing dialogues now for close to 8-9 years across our communities, and we use an Indigenous values-based process. We really try to use the power of storytelling and sharing your story to connect hearts and minds and to understand complex topics like systemic racism on an individual level, but also on a collective level. And so when we dissect and start talking about some of these complicated structures that are in place, we often break it down for people to understand what individual racism looks and feels like, interpersonal, institutional, which could be, you know, within your school or within your office place, and then the systemic. Systemic is often, you know, you can't touch it, you can't feel it, and so it's harder to figure out how you're going to address it. But when you think about the entire education system, you can start to grapple with how systemic racism has unfolded when you look at, you know, the curriculum and how the day is structured and what knowledge is deemed critical and important for our young people. A lot of that is coming from a certain frame of thinking, a Western frame of thinking, and it really benefits students who come from that kind of lifestyle or that kind of family. And so you can start to look at examples of how systemic racism shows up in our systems. One example that I've been using in my work is to think about the game of Monopoly, right? We've all played, we all know the point of the game, and we teach our young kids how to play this game, right? And so for America, if you think about, you know, how our country was founded and formed, it's like saying for hundreds of years, only certain individuals meeting certain requirements were able to purchase property and were able to go to the bank and get a loan and were able to go to college to get the degree to become a doctor. And to be quite frank, that was a lot of Anglo-Saxon, you know, white American and mainly men. And then at some point, due to civil disobedience and different movements, civil rights movements and things that have happened in our country, laws began to change and people of color were now able to play the game of Monopoly. But as you can imagine, you know, the best property was already bought out. New tactics were used to keep people of color kind of marginalized on certain sides of the railroad tracks, for example, or not able to, you know, get the financing that they needed to get the home they were looking for their families. And so you start to understand how, looking at the game of Monopoly, you can understand how in America some of these systemic issues have persisted. And until you're confronted with them, you may go about your entire life without seeing these things, without realizing these things. And then once you do, it can hit you like a ton of bricks. And so that's really why we use a healing circle in our work. We use our indigenous values to ground us in these dialogues. And we really do it through, our method is through love and through the hope that Alaska can be better and do better for our children. And most people respond to that. They themselves kind of are awoken to some of these things that might have been invisible to them previously.
When you're giving the example of Monopoly, you're talking about how some people like literally couldn't purchase property, and that's not just in the analogy, but in real life that has happened. Why? Like, can you give examples of what happened historically that prevented people from being able to purchase property and be part of this capitalistic system that our country is developed upon? Lisa?
I think that, you know, really you have to go back to Manifest Destiny. And you really have to take it all the way back to the doctrines of discovery and, you know, that this foundation of America really was this mission that certain groups went on to claim and colonize America. And, you know, Alaska is really the last piece of that. And so you call it the Great Frontier, right? The Great Land, the last frontier. And so that really is kind of how the non-Native peoples that came up here really looked at this place. It's a place of what you can get out of it. You know, think about the gold rush. Think mm-hmm. about mining in general or, you know, environmental practices. Alaska is really a state where the laws and a lot of the institutions were built up around what you can take from Alaska. As opposed to where the values of a lot of the indigenous people here have a different way of looking at it. So in my particular culture, and I don't speak for all cultures in Alaska, I think I'm always careful to say that, we look at it as a responsibility of stewardship, connection, And that's a really different way of coming to look at this. So we have laws that were put in place to help fulfill that manifest destiny, essentially, such as like the mining laws in 1872, where it stripped away land rights from people that had been living in these ancestral areas for thousands of years. It made it okay for people to come in and homestead and mine in these areas. And there are countless different laws that have been put in place that have been challenging or supporting those systems over time. And, you know, Andrea just used one example of the educational system. But really, if we look at any given system in Alaska, there are challenges inherent in those systems. So you can look at the justice system, where there is a high degree of disproportionality for Alaska Native men in particular in our systems. You can look at the Office of Children's Services, OCS system, where we're highly overrepresented in that system as well. And so when you start to look at the impacts of all of these systems and how we end up getting into those systems and then lost in those systems, it becomes a really complicated and huge thing.
So I'd like to dissect that a little bit. And I guess let's focus in down on OCS. There are a lot more children who are Alaska Native who are involved with OCS, which is the Office of Children's Services and Child Welfare. What has led to that disproportionality? I realize this is an hour-long conversation that we could have in and of itself, but like, are there ways to pinpoint sort of specifically what has led to?
Well, it's still morning. This is a little heavy for morning discussion, but thank you for asking that question. I think a lot of people have a very negative perception of my community of Bethel in my region and of my culture. And a lot of people look at us as an example of things gone wrong. And I think we are the exact opposite of that. We are the example of resilience and beauty. We're still here. We are still, you know, speaking our language. We are still dancing and practicing our culture despite everything that was, you know, against all odds. And so I think that for me, my learning has really come to, as Lisa was talking about, this mission, kind of this mission mindset in my community. You know, the missionaries, which were, you know, church groups that came from the East Coast, looked at a map of Alaska and they dissected where they were going to save the uncivilized Native people, essentially. And a lot of things that happened during that time included, you know, child sexual abuse, breaking up families, you know, burning of our regalia, very, very destructive things that happened to our people. You know, maybe this is 3, 4, 5 generations back, but that's still, it's still very contemporary when you think about the 1,000 or 10,000 plus years of existence as a people. And so what we have learned is that what happened, you know, 4 and 5 generations back, it has had damaging effects up until present day. Some folks will call that historical trauma. In our work at First Alaskans, we prefer intergenerational trauma because historical implies that it kind of just stays in the past. Intergenerational, you know, it has lingering effects across generations and how, you know, being raised by people in the church and not being raised by your own family and a community that loves you will have lingering effects with how people parent today in 2018. And so because of some of these intergenerational traumas, I think we're, as a Native community, we're still waking up. We're still waking up to these truths. And until, you know, we can launch more of a healing process collectively where we can address the true history of this place and what's happened on our lands, that we can start to let go and end those cycles of abuse and show what a positive parenting and community-based, you know, raising a family, raising a child, what that looks like, restoring some of our rites of passage and the way that we, you know, gather our food, put food up together, the way we care for one another, I think the pendulum is moving in that direction.
And I would also add to that that, you know, we got to take some of the burden off of the people too, because one of the things that I hear all the time is, you know, that was in the past. My people didn't do that. I'm not racist and my people didn't do these things. But the reality is racism didn't just one day stop. It's still here. It's still in these systems and institutions and in individual values. I mean, we see it now in this political climate, this very divided political climate we're in. So you have to think, here's a people that had all of these traumas thrust upon them. I mean, all the research now is showing that this is impacting our DNA. Like, we're carrying these traumas of our family members and our ancestors with us. So when we're trying to heal, we're healing the past, we're trying to heal the present, and we're also trying to heal the future. That's a lot of pressure to put on people. And then it's compounded by the fact that, you know, there are these power systems in position now that are pitting people of poverty against people of color. And that really is doing a disservice to the issue of racism, because it actually fosters this kind of animosity.
You're listening to Talk of Alaska, and today we are talking about systemic racism in our system, and we are going to go to the phones. We have Sonia from Sitka on the line. Sonia, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hello?
Hello? Sonia, you're on Talk of Alaska.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we can. Thank you.
Okay. I'm really loving the broadcast so far. This is really great. So I work with teenagers here in Sitka, and I don't know. I think I walk on eggshells a little too much, especially when it comes to the issues and speaking to the issues of racism, because one of the things that I'm caught up in is the fact that although our program is largely Native, meaning that I work directly with Native youth, I don't think there's enough support in place to provide, like, what happens with them afterward, after they're done with our 6 month, 9 month, and 12 month program. Sometimes they graduate, sometimes they drop out, but I think one of the major issues that I face is, even though I am a paraprofessional, I find that my success rate is pretty good. And I really think that it's because of my race. And it makes me uncomfortable to say that, but that is the truth. And it's very effective because I will speak about it, because I believe that everybody deserves the truth. And so I think the issue is what happens to them afterwards, because, you know, these are youth who face incarceration if they don't graduate. I think it becomes a social justice problem.
Sonia, what's your program that you're working with?
It's called Youth Advocates of Sitka.
Mm-hmm. And it's a program focused around youth graduation?
Youth incarceration.
Okay. And Lisa.
So, you know, I appreciate that you're bringing that up. It is a really important, that's really important work to me as well. And youth, they've got so many challenges nowadays. I mean, the youth incarceration rates in the juvenile justice system are very disproportionate for our people. And so it is, you know, the truth is the antidote, right? We have to be able to recognize our stories, and our stories come with some painful truths. And so you have to find a way to be able to safely share those stories and then transform them into strengths. And that's hard to do. You know, I'm doing my own journey on that, and
And I find a lot of strength in that. But for youth who are coming from challenging situations, and this doesn't have to be just Alaska Native youth. You know, this is all youth. Mm-hmm. It's a difficult time to be youth, right? We have social media and all these things. So really, we take a lot of pride in our community in trying to listen to the youth voice and trying to make a space for that youth voice. Because we need to understand people's experiences. We need to connect and really listen to each other. And I think it's really important what she's doing, the work around, you know, sharing that truth with them. And, you know, I wish going back, and I'm proud to say I'm 53, and I wish in my youth that I would have understood some of these contextual things that my family lived through and some of the systems that were put in place way back before I was born that impacted my life. And, you know, I know a lot of people say, oh, well, that's just you being victim, right? People will say that to you when you try and address race. You're being a victim. You know, you're letting the racism issue, playing the race card, right? Let's just say that. But the reality is, it's just a way of describing your experience, your lived experience in this state, in this world. And so I think it's amazing what she's doing. I encourage people to talk about it. I mean, that's part of the work we're doing. That's part of the uncomfortable work that we're doing. I really appreciate First Alaskans because they're doing a lot of this really powerful work. And it's something I'm trying to do in my local community as well. And I think it's important.
Yeah, Sonia, thank you for your call. There's a couple things that come to mind for me. What I hear you saying is that the youth are more responsive to you because you're someone that they can establish trust with. You're someone that they want to really open up and you, they want to believe you, believe that path that you're saying is possible for them. And I think what that's speaking to on a broader level is that the more that we can have our culture and our people and our traditions and our languages and our values reflected and integrated into the services that are meant to help us, that is where we're going to see the more lasting results. And that is what we are pushing in terms of the systems, in terms of the Office of Children's Services, looking for ways for that institution to be more grounded in the cultural practices of the families and children that they're meaning to serve. And so that's kind of what I hear you say, what I hear a little bit of what you're saying, Sonia, in terms of the youth that you spend time with having a little bit higher success rate than maybe your non-Native counterparts. I think the more that we can have culture integrated into those programs, the stronger and the more, longer lasting impact, less recidivism, mm-hmm. that we will see.
Mm-hmm. And Andrea, First Alaskans has been hosting these conversations and or conversations with Office of Children's Services around issues of race and around issues of disproportionality. And it's having a difference, right?
Yeah, so you talk about and/or. That is mm-hmm. Advancing Native Dialogues on Racial Equity. AND/OR is kind of our acronym, and we've been hosting AND/OR dialogues across Alaska, including with the state of Alaska and, yes, with the Office of Children's Services. I would say for about 3 years, we've been hosting these dialogues. And initially, you know, it was quite contentious. You know, folks in the room who were quite opposed, formerly litigating one another, in a room, in a circle, to start fleshing out why the disproportionality, why these numbers, why these high turnover rates, why is there not enough foster families, you know, really looking at what we call with the elephant in the room and just kind of one dialogue at a time getting to a place where the people around the table, around the circles, are building trust and they're really starting to see how they each have Alaska's children at the heart of why they show up every day for what it is that they do. And through a series of dialogues, getting to a point where OCS was able to develop a strategic plan. And within that strategic plan was, you know, government-to-government relationship with Alaska's 229 tribes. And Commissioner Davidson and Governor Walker took that further by signing a historic compact at AFN convention last year, where they are now recognizing that if they work side by side with our tribes and our tribal organizations, that we will have better culturally grounded services, families who trust those who are, you know, seeking to help them, a more lasting impact. And from what I've seen, the numbers in terms of the Alaska Native numbers are going in the right direction as a result of this kind of policy change that's been unfolding.
Sonia, thank you very much for your call, and thank you very much for bringing up topics surrounding building trust and open conversations. I'd like to go now to John, also in Sitka. John, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Well, thank you for having me. Yeah, I'm an Alaska Native, full-blood Tlingit from Huna. Been in construction all my life. And the biggest problem I have when I'm looking for work is the first thing they ask is, how long are you sober? And I've been sober 30 years now, and that's been the main push. Is the first thing they do is ask you, are you a drinker? Or, you know, they're worried about you coming back. And so a lot of the people that have went into this field do that, but, you know, not everybody. And I'm been in construction for 30-plus years, and I have about $30,000 in brand new tools here in Sitka, but the prejudice is so high here, I couldn't even get a job in construction, and I've been in construction all my life. So the discrimination law that is in state of Alaska is not strong enough, because now, you know, they worried about the state not having enough money. If they put us all to work rather than, you know, giving us piecemeal food stamps, all of that kind of stuff. If they put us to work, then we would all be in better shape if they, you know, put us, give us a way to go to work. I was applying for a loan from my bank. Couldn't even get a loan to start a business here in Sitka. And so discrimination is really bad. And when they use alcohol as a way of deterring you getting a job, you know, that is the thing that I always had to deal with every year, is convince the construction company that I am sober. And one of the things that is apparent in that statement, my mom went to a restaurant and cut her tongue with a piece of glass in her mouth. And the first thing the guy said is, how much have you had to drink? So they use alcohol as a way not to hire you, or a way to show that you are you did it yourself. The lawsuit is going to be a waste of time. And so alcohol is really a big push in the state to keep us from working, and to see how prejudice is really strong here in Alaska. Is all of us Native people were working at one time, either fishing, logging, or all of that, but not anymore.
Lisa,
so they got what they wanted. They got us out of work. They got us depending on them. So one of the other things that I see is our own prejudice in our own people. Because we got territorial schools and boarding schools. The people that went to territorial schools were people that looked white. Went to boarding schools were all Native. You look in the corporations, most of those are people that went to territorial schools that looked white.
John, I'd like to go ahead and let Lisa and Andrea have a little bit of response to, because you've just brought up so many points.
Lisa. Yeah, John, thank you for probably the best overt racism example that is out there. Alcohol has been used as a weapon against our people for far too long. It's, you know, you unfortunately, if you read any of the comments on any of the articles, that's one of the first things they bring up. You know, they wouldn't bring that up for any other people, right? That comes up too much for our people. And, you know, I know that there's a lot of the same kind of struggle. Like, there's overt racism, you know, there's in-your-face racism, but there's covert racism, there's subtle racism, you know. People may be thinking these things and just not saying them, right? So we've got all these different layers to this. You know, one of the things, John, that I would suggest, though, is, like, we have a human rights commission in Alaska. The state of Alaska has a commission for just these type of incidents, I think. You know, if employers are using practices like this and this kind of language with people, they need to be held accountable for that. Like, that's not okay in this day and age.
And would he just have to document it somehow, or would any individual just have to document it? Or
I think, you know, and I was on the human rights site the other day looking at the cases, and, you know, they go on fact-finding, so it may be found unfounded, it may be a he said, she said, but it's still something that I think should be reported. If there's an employer out there that is intentionally not hiring Alaska Native people for that very reason, they should be held accountable. And so even filing the case, you know, lets people know that this employer has these practices, and maybe it will have them take a look at, you know, their hiring practices.
Yeah, I think John also raises another important topic regarding racism, which deals with the economic impact of systemic racism. At First Alaskans, we partner with ICER and other research groups. And, you know, when we come to our brainstorming table, Liz, my boss, and I, we're trying to find a way to help paint this picture for them with folks who study economies. And we can't seem to get to the same kind of vision. But essentially, what we've been trying to illustrate is how much economic impact we are seeing in Alaska. This example, I think, is one where we're seeing local folks not able to get employed within their community. That means, you know, maybe it's somebody coming in from lower 48, or coming, you know, a short timer who's just going to get their check and spend their money elsewhere. And I think that when you look at the incarceration rate and you look at some of these other places where people are not actively involved in our local economies, it's having really devastating, you know, that trickle-down effect. And I think we haven't yet as a state been able to tell that story. But I think John's demonstrating one very concrete example of how racism does impact local economies.
It's a really powerful example, I think.
We need to take a quick break, but then we'll be back with more of your calls on Talk of Alaska. The number is 1-800-478-8255. John, thank you for your call. We'll be right back.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. Do you want to work at a job that contributes to the health of your community? Well, Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium, or SEARCH, is hiring. SEARCH offers full-time jobs that include health, vision, and dental benefits, as well as paid time off and retirement savings. For more information, visit search.org/jobs and view open positions. Start a rewarding career helping others at SEARCH. Healthy is here. This message sponsored by the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Today we're talking about systemic racism. Have you tried to talk with coworkers or friends about racial equity? How did it go? How are you hosting those conversations? Let us know by calling 1-800-478-8255 or in Anchorage 550-8422. That's 1-800-478-8255. And we are going to go to the phone lines. We have Carl on the line. Carl, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Oh, thank you so much. I want to thank John for bringing up the whole issue of economic opportunity and employment. And I want to thank the First Alaskans Institute for for these dialogues that you mentioned. Early in state government, I served in state government in the mid-70s, and since that time, I've noticed a kind of a disturbing, well, it's a positive trend and then a disturbing trend in that our professional Native organizations, our Native corporations, and our health entities are doing an excellent job of hiring our shareholders and promoting Native professionals in those organizations. Meanwhile, it looks to me like state government and the federal government are not doing the job they should be doing. And so my question is, what are the trends that the Institute sees in both state and federal agencies in diversity hire, and do they have any goals anymore? Do they publish their diversity data? And finally, to the point of the political climate, this seems like the perfect year for those running for governor to talk about this. So that's my question. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your call, Carl. Andrew, you may not have that data in front of you, but I do know that you've had a lot of conversations around hiring and those practices.
Yeah, so I haven't looked at those numbers in terms of their rate of hire of Alaska Native or other people of color, but I would want to talk about not just filling lower level entry level positions with people of color to reach higher numbers. I think that we have so many capable and innovative and driven people of color and Alaska Native leaders who could be serving at the highest levels, and we do have a few serving at some of those higher levels, but all the way up, middle management, program directors. I think the more that we see people of color reflected in our state and our federal government will be a plus. When you look at the numbers of children being born, most of them are a mix. They're diverse. They're beautiful. They're beautiful children. And the more they see people who look like their parents or who look like people they aspire to be, the more they see themselves reflected in those positions, I think it's a positive outcome.
Yeah, it's almost infectious to be around people that are such powerful leaders. One of my sister's mentors is Liz Medicine Crow, and she is such an inspiration to me. And I think it's true. The more you're around this leadership and the more the leadership around us gets developed up, you really see this power and this beauty that comes from the values that we share and our connections. And I really do wish it could trickle up into our political systems a little bit more, where we're a little bit better represented.
So within workplaces, how do you change the culture so that people are hiring people of color versus not?
I think I'll address that. So I'm really excited right now because in my community, we're doing a lot of work around racial equity. We recognized early on out in the Matsu Borough that we were having some challenge with this and had a bit of a reputation around it, I think. And so we quickly came together with a coalition called Rock Matsu, and it's Raising Our Children with Kindness. And it was really a great footing for us to bring a lot of nonprofits together, a lot of educational system people together, different diverse groups together, to kind of look at how we can strengthen our community, how we can make things better for our children. Not one particular group of children over another, but all of our children. And then strengthen our families and our community. And part of that work really very quickly became clear to us that we needed to do some work around trauma-informed systems, right? And then it also became clear that we needed to do some racial equity work, and because you can't have trauma-informed systems if they're not racially just, right? So we've been doing things like hosting undoing racism trainings in our community.
And can you explain what those are?
Sure. They are a facilitated conversation that takes place over 3 days, and they're hosted by the People's Institute for Survival and Beyond. They tell the sort of a true history. They break down all the definitions of racism. They tell kind of this true history of manifest destiny and how it's impacted people all across the nation. A lot of things, people don't know that story because, let's face it, the history books aren't written by our people. And so there's a lot of confusion around history in our country. And so we teach this definitions, the history, and then we call on people to look within their own structures to see where these issues are being perpetuated. And we say, if you are not taking a look, an honest look at your role in perpetuating racism within these systems, then you're part of the problem versus part of the solution. And so we're really trying to take that solution approach to building a healthier community. So we've had like 100 people go through this program so far, and we've got another two cohorts of 40 people planning to go through as well over the next couple of months.
So when people go through the Undoing Racism classes, they come out with a greater understanding of the history and a greater understanding of, I'm assuming, also our implicit biases.
Right.
Do they also come out with a plan of, now you understand and you feel these things, okay, then what next? Like, what's
so
tangible?
So unfortunately, that was kind of a learning experience for us. We realized very early on that we were shock valuing people. Like, we were basically shaking them to the core with this information. We would have people come in with their arms folded and not wanting to be there and, you know, just really resistant to even taking a look at these issues. And then we would give them so much information. I could see their heads were, you know, bobbling and splitting, and they really were taking it in. And then the feedback we were getting was that, well, I don't know what to do about all this. And so really recently, we've partnered with First Alaskans on this to come out and host an Andor dialogue the last day of our training. And that's really going to be that solutions piece where we work together to kind of say, okay, what are our next steps in our community? Like, what do we want to vision for our community? You know, how do we want to move forward together in this work?
Nice. We are going to go back to the phone lines. We have Kathleen from Ketchikan on the line. Kathleen, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I ran into a problem with employment with the school district down here because my son, who had cancer, had to receive his treatment at Alaska Native Medical Center, which requires a day travel up and a day travel back, and then appointments, and sometimes the appointments run over. I mean, anybody who's been ANMC from the villages understands this. So I was basically fired because of his medical condition, and he had Medicaid, but it was restricted Medicaid, and they kept saying, why doesn't he just get treated down here? Well, he couldn't. There were all these barriers, and so my union did nothing for me. They didn't see it as a racial issue, whatever it was. But I called the Alaska Human Rights Commission, and they took the case. But they didn't file it under racism. It was the complaint was filed under the ADA. And, you know, I kind of questioned that, but whatever. It worked. I got my job back. I got my back pay. I got all my leave. I got everything. But what I'm saying is that people often don't fight these, but you can feel it. It's just what you were talking about. You can feel it. It's like they don't get it. They make these rules, you know, the culture, the dominant culture makes these rules, and you have to conform. And if you don't fit into those rules, or if you can't fit into those rules, then, you know, you're out. You're just out. It doesn't work for you. And it's just not right.
Thank you so much for your call, Kathleen. You have brought up so many issues. I mean, one thing I'd love to explore, if you all are up for it, is this idea that Kathleen just mentioned that, like, some people don't realize when race is impacting the situation. How do you have those conversations? How do you have conversations around that and help people realize that? And, like, yeah, how do you have that conversation?
So, well, we both are fighting to answer this one.
Well, right off the bat, I think that there are, you know, when she's talking about the dominant system expects us to conform, that's kind of the mantra that I see in terms of equality. Like, this law, it's black and white, Everyone has an equal chance to participate. Everyone has an equal chance to break this law. And there's this concept of equality, this everyone is equal, whereas with equity, equity is rather everyone has the chance to live freely who they are, their value system, and have that beautiful makeup of who they are, that they can walk into the door and be treated equitably with folks who are different than them. And I think this is an example of maybe how her employer was seeing a situation. Everyone has an equal chance to show up to work, not understanding that because of the healthcare system, this individual had to go through many hoops in order to get her son the care that he needed. And to me, that is an equity issue. Is the employer going to look at her way of life, her situation, her circumstances in an equitable manner and maybe a little more leeway because of that? Or are they just going to say, well, you're going to be treated equal to everyone else, and if you can't be here this day, you know, for me, that's an example of how you can differentiate how employers or society looks at those two concepts.
Yeah, and I really like the notion of cultural humility. I think it calls on us, and I know I'm on this journey because I don't know everything about every single culture in the world. There's a lot of them, right? Even in our state, we have 229 villages with distinctive cultures. We have families within those villages with distinctive cultures. And so it's really a case of, you know, being culturally centered in the work you do, being open to recognizing that you don't have all the answers about people, and really being willing to explore, you know, our commonalities and our differences, and then focus on our commonalities together, the things that we all value that are important. You know, we Andrea and I were talking on break about this us and them, and we were very aware that we, you know, we don't want to fall into that. We want to keep moving towards our connection with each other. And that's really the work I'm trying to do in my community, is to build these networks. I love how First Alaskans approaches this. We're linking arms together. And that's really what we're trying to do. You know, it's so easy in this day and age to be polarized, and especially around issues of poverty and race. But, you know, where's that going to get us? You know, it's gotten us where we are, really. And we need to keep looking beyond that at our own individual journey. It's easy to say other people are racist without looking back inward at yourself to kind of take an assessment of your own power and privilege, because every single one of us has some privilege over another person, essentially. But that doesn't really address the issues of the systemic racism. So each of us has to look at our role within the systems as well. If you're within one of those systems and you're not challenging those unjust rules, then, you know, you're not doing your part to address racism, right?
Yeah, and a minute ago, Anne, you asked about solution building. Our dialogue work is built around the process of co-creating solutions and actions. And I think that's where the power really lies, is that you're working collaboratively in a dialogue space, looking at the collective, where is there synergy and alignment around this vision that we have for racial equity. It's co-created. It's not First Alaskans or any community, Chicoloon, or, you know, any one individual or community saying this is what we are striving for. Everyone get in line behind this vision. No, we want to, through our dialogue process, get to know one another, hear our stories, and then co-create that path forward so everyone knows their piece of responsibility. I was in Hawaii recently, and they say that they're kuleana. What is their life responsibility? How are they going to show up in the world? How are they going to show up and make that vision happen? We all have to play a role in that. We can't just wait for, you know, a new governor to come around. I agree with the caller who, you know, said this topic should be, you know, on the campaign trail so we get to know where our candidates stand on these issues. But they can't ultimately fix this problem. Right. And so each individual, you know, with the power that we have in our families and in our lives, working towards a vision of racial equity, so that, you know, all of our children are living in wellness, in well-being, and that we are on this healing journey, healing path.
Yeah. And I would add to that, too. I think people have this this resistance to even looking at the issue of racism. They just, it's an uncomfortable topic. Even we're seasoned at talking about this, and even we're a little bit kind of tiptoeing around some things. But the reality is, like, we have to be able to fully have these conversations. And that's what's so great about the Andor Dialogues, because if we can't really be our truest self in those conversations, then we're not addressing it. It's just there. It's hanging in the air around us.
We are going to take a really quick break, and then we'll be back to continue that thought here on Talk of Alaska.
Funding for Talk of Alaska was made possible in part by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority and listeners just like you. Thank you. It's back to school time. Backpack ready, school supplies check. But what about your child's vaccinations? Before school starts is a great time to talk to your health care provider or a local public health center to make sure your child's vaccinations are current. Vaccinations protect your child and the whole community against serious diseases. Learn more, including where to get free vaccines, at immunize.dhss.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by DHSS.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Today we're talking about systemic racism. Lisa, right before the break, you were saying that even though you have conversations around this topic all the time, you still end up sort of tiptoeing around things. How, and maybe this is too broad of a question, but how do people become comfortable talking about race?
Well, I think the reason that I get uncomfortable around it is that I always know that when I'm out here, you know, I'm a tribal leader, I'm from a community, and the words that I lay down in other people's land, ancestral lands, you know, have an impact on not just my tribe, but potentially on all Alaska Native people, right? So it's a heavy weight to choose the right words, because I don't want something that I say or my approach to negatively impact other people. And, you know, that's certainly not how I approach the work. So sometimes these truths are messy and ugly. And when you put them out there, they're met with resistance. So you have to, unfortunately, be willing to stand behind those words sometimes. So it just is it's an uncomfortable place to live. But I find the older I get, the more people that I learn from, the mentors that I have, really the elders that I've learned of their experiences, that it becomes easier to stand up in terms of protecting the next generations. Because we don't want our children and their children to experience some of the same things that our ancestors experienced and some of the things that we've experienced in life. And so it's my responsibility. Responsibility you'll hear a lot from our people, because that's how we live in this world. We have responsibility to our environment, to each other, and so it's something that it's almost like a calling in a way, because we have that responsibility to try and make things better.
I would add, too, that, you know, talking about racism and racial equity, systemic racism, it's not casual break room chit chat. You know, a lot of our everyday conversations are pretty surface level. And so when you approach a deep topic, people kind of have to be ready. In our work, we try to demand at least 4 hours if people really want us to delve in these topics. Multi-day is excellent. If we're able to get the audience for longer periods of time, then you really are able to shift hearts and minds and get to that point of transforming the way people think about these topics. But in our agreements, you know, we talk about speak to be understood and listen to understand. And so if people are willing to be vulnerable and share their truth, you have to know that the person across from you is actually listening deeply and not judging you, but rather if they don't agree, it's a chance for them to be curious and to ask more questions rather than, you know, putting up walls between us. So it's both. It's a burden on the person sharing, but it's also a burden on the person listening, and how are they going to tap into that deep listening to really truly come to a point of understanding.
So when you're doing this, this deep listening and this deep understanding,
and you come up into a situation where it's really uncomfortable, or like the person just actually isn't listening, how do you deal with your own feelings of pain or anger? Especially because you are bringing up a lot of history that isn't comfortable.
I think that's definitely something that I had to come to terms with. And really, it's a developing process. I mean, you can still feel when you have some conversations with people and they totally disagree with you. You know, you can read it on their face and you can just know that they're not ready for that conversation yet. And that's okay, because people have to come to things in their own time. In my community, in my situation, there was quite a bit of an uncomfortable time. I used to say that I would have to kick the door open to seat myself at the table for these conversations. And they were uncomfortable, and people didn't want to hear this. They didn't want to think about how racial equity was playing out in their nonprofits, but they're serving a disproportionate number of our people. And so, you know, I do a lot of individual training, a lot of one-on-one training, but I, for a long time, I felt I had to wrestle with my own feelings of, are people ever going to be ready for these conversations? Am I ever going to be welcomed at that table? Am I ever going to have people open the door for me instead of having to kick it open? I joke. And I'm happy to say that that's kind of happening now. You know, on my Facebook feed the other day, some of the people that I'm in the coalition with out there at Rock Mat Sioux, and I'm also on the Alaska Resilience Initiative, which is doing the same kind of work. One of the people that I'm on that coalition work with posted this article out there, and it was clearly a racist article. And it was so awesome because she said, "We've got to do something about this." And I thought, okay, my work here is done, because people are now recognizing and seeing these things. So we're definitely making strides. These communications, these dialogues are giving me hope that we can come together and we can build that better future. You know, as long as people are willing to engage in the conversations, then I think that I can still keep doing this work. And for me, it really was an internal transformation of coming to terms with my own anger and frustration and sadness and grief and loss, and transforming that into a way of leading with love. So every person I come in contact with, you'll often see me hug people. You'll often see that we embrace people in the work.
Share food. Laughter, go for a walk on the land.
The good things.
Creating community around these conversations. That is all we have time for today. Thank you both very much for being here. My guests today were Andrea Sanders with First Alaskans and Lisa Wade with the Chicxulub Village Traditional Council. Next week, we will be talking about Rock Mat Sioux and delving into what collaborations can do.
Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at matson.com. The Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium featured open positions include CMAs and LPNs for their primary care clinics in Southeast Alaska. Come work for Search and contribute to your community. Enjoy full benefits, paid time off, and retirement savings. Search is looking for someone like you. For more information, visit search.org/jobs. That's search.org/jobs to apply. This message sponsored by the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium. This program is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400. This is Alaska Public Media.